This is The Feed, York Region's only news magazine dedicated to the issues, events, and stories that matter to all of us who live and work here.
This is The Feed, York Region's longest-running and exclusive news magazine. I'm Ann Rohmer. Welcome. On the show, the Netflix documentary based on the Markham Murder for Hire case. Women's sports breaking attendance records and significant changes in charitable giving. But we begin with the declining interest in family medicine. Right now, over 2 million people are without a family physician. That number could more than double to 4.4 million by the year 2026. And to add insult to injury, according to the OMA, for the third year in a row, there was a decline in the number of medical students seeking residency with family doctors. What needs to be done to turn the tide so that more future physicians choose a path to family medicine and those who are already family doctors don't close their practices? Joining us now to discuss is Dr. Lori DeSanto, Chief of Family Practice at McKenzie Health. Really glad that you could join us today. Thank you so much, Dr. DeSanto.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about these numbers. It's very disconcerting that medical students are turning away from family practice. What's causing challenges for these med students?
I think we really need to think about this as both a recruitment and retention problem. So when we're talking about medical students, we're talking about the recruitment side of the problem. We need to recognize, in order to make family practice more attractive for medical students, we need to make family practice more attractive for our current family physicians who are in comprehensive family practice at the moment. From the most immediate perspective, we really have to think about that retention piece. Our medical students in their training are training within these family practices in the community. So they see what's out there. They see the primary care crisis, the environment that family physicians are working in. They recognize that there's a huge administrative burden, that there's lack of work-life balance, there's lots of burnout and exhaustion, and a lot of barriers to care as well, causing moral distress among family physicians. So when medical students are seeing this, this is certainly not inspiring and motivating them to go into family medicine themselves.
So the bottom line is the increasing costs associated with running a family practice or even setting one up are becoming astronomical. Also, what I'm hearing from doctors everywhere across the province is the excessive administrative work. In other words, too much paperwork leaves too little time to care for patients.
This is definitely true. And I think it's important when we talk about administrative work to recognize that as family physicians, we know that there is a certain degree of administrative work that goes along with direct patient care. And there's no way around that. We know that there's going to be some degree of it. However, what we've seen over the past many years is really just a ballooning of the administrative work. Studies have shown that every hour of direct patient care leads to at least 1 hour and maybe sometimes even 2 hours of administrative work. And that work is often work that's done after hours. We go through our entire day seeing patients, and then there's these extra hours of administrative work that need to be done. So they often get done at home on personal time and on the weekends. And the only way around that is to decrease our time in direct contact with patients, and which is what we don't want to do, right? We want to be able to have our patients have access to us. This is really where I think the strain is coming in with the administrative work.
And what is that paperwork, the administrative work? What exactly is it that has to be filled out and noted each and every day?
There's the documentation of the visit. You know, when we take a history and we do a physical exam and we come up with a treatment plan, we need to document all of that in the patient medical record. That's very important documentation, and it needs to be done very thoroughly as well. So that's one element of it. There's multiple other elements, though, that we put in the category of administrative work. So whenever we order a test, whether it's a lab test or an imaging test, whenever we make a referral and one of our patients sees a specialist or accesses care in the emergency department, all of those visits and tests result in administrative work that we have to do, right? We have to review those test results and make clinical decisions. We need to read through consult notes and emergency visit notes or inpatient notes and sort through what happened with the patient and what things we may have to take action on. So that's another element of administrative work. Third element of administrative work is things like forms that need to be filled out. So there's some simple things like, for example, sick notes and that sort of thing, which often are very sort of low-value administrative work that would be best to be completely eliminated if possible. And then there's things like insurance forms that can be very time-consuming. The forms are often different between different insurance companies. There's no consistency throughout that. And so, again, these are things that we need to do for our patients. It's very important that we're able to complete these forms for our patients. But, again, they have to be done on top of all of our direct patient care. And I do think there is an element of, honestly, a way that we can streamline some of these forms, shorten them, make them more consistent across the board. And in many cases, eliminating forms that really don't require a family physician to sign off on, but that just have traditionally been directed towards the family physician to complete.
Now, it's my understanding that not only are you in a position that you are, which is the chief of family practice at Mackenzie Health, you also have a family practice on the go. When you first started, what was it like? And is it very different today?
I had always really known that I wanted to do comprehensive family practice. And once I was done my residency, I went out into family practice. I opened up a family practice as a solo doc. That was actually a feasible thing to do back then. This was, you know, 19 years ago now. Over the years, I kind of recognized that as things were shifting in medicine, that it really didn't work very well to function as a solo family physician. You needed to have colleagues to bounce ideas off of, bounce patient cases off of, so that you had a way of benchmarking what you were doing from a patient care perspective, and also to have that cross-coverage support. You know, if you're a family physician with a family practice and you need to be away for even a day, you do need somebody to be able to help cover those urgent visits that need to come in and be seen. And also just information like lab reports and tests and things that are coming in that may be urgent and need to be urgently acted upon.
It also underscores the need for new family doctors. And that brings me back to recruitment. You had talked about retention, and now let's focus on recruitment. And the sad state of affairs that so many med students are saying no thanks to the path toward being a family doctor. So it's really great news when the provincial budget was tabled recently. The new School of Medicine at York University is going to be built in Vaughan beside Mackenzie Health's Cortellucci Vaughan Hospital. So that's great. Will the focus now, though, shift when it comes to training our future doctors to be family physicians?
Yes, I think the wonderful thing that I see with the York University School of Medicine, and definitely we're going in the right direction, this is part of our long-term solution for this recruitment issue, is that it is an innovative approach, right? It really is a community-based approach to training medical students that has a very large focus on primary care. And I think if we can create a supportive learning environment for medical students where they are working in the community, in interprofessional teams, where they can see that there is this wonderful collaboration amongst all healthcare providers, and they've got that positive role modeling and mentorship throughout their training, then I do think that it will make family practice much more attractive for medical students. And the hope is that not only will they choose family medicine, but that once they're done their residency program, that they'll actually want to go out into comprehensive family practice and stay within our community where they were trained, because they know that it's a supportive environment, that they've got lots of access to resources. And I think we have to remember, though, in order to create that supportive learning environment, it brings us right back to retention again, because those family physicians of today that are out in the community are going to be the teachers for our next generation of family doctors in the future.
Dr. Lori DeSanto, Chief of Family Practice at McKenzie Health, thank you so much for your words of encouragement.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
There's also been a decline in donations and a notable gap between Canadians' intent to give and the action they take. Tina Cortez with that story.
Nicole Danese is Senior Manager of PR and Unite for Change with Canada Helps. Thanks for your time, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with the highlights from the Giving Report, and what does it tell us about the challenges faced by the charitable sector post-pandemic?
Yes, so the Giving Report is an annual report that we publish every year at Canada Helps, and it's a really cornerstone report for charities across the country and also Canadians to get a sense in terms of the challenges or the opportunities that are facing charities. The report really highlights that fewer Canadians are giving, and that is an 11-year consecutive decline that we have highlighted in this year's report, which is quite alarming. While at the same time, many charities are still dealing with a heightened sense of demand for their services.
Okay, but this is, as you said, an 11-year consecutive decline. What is causing that decline, do you think?
So our report dives into a few of a bit of a hypothesis in terms of what we're thinking potentially is leading to this 11-year consecutive decline. And it's based on survey data from a survey that we conducted with Ledger. And there are multiple factors, of course, one being inflation and affordability. Other factors have involved, for example, fewer Canadians feeling connected to religion, because religion and charitable giving is so closely tied together, with many people donating to whether it's their mosque or their church or their synagogue, for example. So there's a number of different factors. Now, the other factor that we've highlighted in this year's report, which is quite interesting, is we've all just been through a pandemic, and the pandemic has unfortunately caused so many of us to be, you know, socially isolated and really losing sort of that close connection that we once had potentially with family and friends. And it's not just, of course, the only reason for that was the pandemic. For example, social media, isolation, other major factors that have contributed to this. And we found that individuals who have fewer closer friends donate less than individuals that have more or many close friends. So there's that interesting sort of dynamic that is also at play that's highlighted in this year's research.
Many interesting findings, that's for sure. What lessons do you think can charities learn from working through the pandemic? Because it appears as if systems are stretched. How can they prepare for a future crisis?
We also highlight in the report, just on the topic of future crisis, that we highlight in the report in terms of the environment and sort of this looming climate crisis that some would say is here on our doorsteps. When we look at wildfires, for example, that really hit almost all provinces and territories last year, for example, and many charities are being affected by that. If they're a food bank, for example, or a shelter, for example, we've highlighted in the report this year a number of different charities across the country that anecdotally have experienced a increase in service demand when it comes to trying to respond to those crises, environmental crises or otherwise. So that's, or for example, you know, charities that have tried to respond to other issues, for example, individuals fleeing from other parts of the world, coming to Canada to seek refuge, of course, seeking a safe place to live, and trying to support that demand. So it is critical for charities to continue to really express their impact to their supporters and really communicate their needs so that individuals like you and I can understand how I can help my food bank around the corner or how I can volunteer or get involved, for example.
You know, Nicole, you mentioned increase in service demand. With more and more relying on food banks and other charitable services, it likely also means that fewer have the means to give. How can charities navigate the unique and current challenges?
It's really a double-edged sword when you think about it. Mm-hmm. At the same time of demand that is still really at levels that I think you could probably safely say we have not seen in a very long time. Recent research that we conducted at Canada Helps in the fall highlighted the fact that 1 in 5 Canadians are turning to charitable services like food and shelter for assistance. And I almost want to repeat that in terms of 1 in 5, like let that sink in for a moment. At the same time, as I stated, fewer Canadians are giving. Now, the silver lining to this is our data and also data from other sources have indicated that those individuals who are still donating are donating in higher amounts. So that's sort of the good news to all of this. But we're still relying on a shrinking pool of donors. And we want to raise that awareness so that individuals that may not have realized that they haven't supported a charity in a very long time can reconsider and see how that fits into their budget.
Nicole, thank you for sharing the report and, you know, even the silver lining. If listeners want more information on Canada Helps and the report in detail, how do they connect with you?
Listeners can go to www.canadahelps.org and you can download the report, and you can also browse from 85,000 registered Canadian charities to find one that you may want to support yourself.
Thanks, Nicole. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, the mayor of Vaughan and Andrea Bocelli, that story is coming up on The Feed.
Do you have a story idea for The Feed? Call us at 416-335-1059 or email info@1059theregion.com. Ann Romer and more of The Feed coming up. This is 1059 The Region. This is The Feed, York Region's only news magazine dedicated to the issues, events, and stories that matter to all of us who live and work here.
Welcome back. It's been a very busy month for the city of Vaughan and for its mayor. A new car rallies bylaw announcement to help keep the peace, an innovative plan to boost tourism in Vaughan, and sharing the stage with a global singing sensation, all in a day's work for Mayor Stephen Del Duca. Welcome to The Feed. Good to have you with us.
It's always fantastic to be on The Feed with you, Anne. Thank you.
Let's begin with the world's most beloved tenor, Andrea Bocelli. What was it like to meet him in person and to hand him the key to the city of Vaughan?
Oh, it was really and truly the honor of a lifetime for me and for my colleagues from council who were also there to be on the stage with him, to present the key, you know, after he performed at a charity event supporting such a worthwhile organization. Like it couldn't have been any more exciting for me. And I'm really thrilled because I know that here in the city of Vaughan, obviously home to a very large Italian-Canadian population, but also people from every background and every culture who recognize he's an extraordinary person, yes, for his singing and his talent, but also because he is such a supporter of philanthropy right around the world. So it was awesome.
I'll bet it was. And did you converse off stage, or was it strictly what we saw on stage?
pretty much strictly on stage. Not surprisingly, it was a bit it was a bit busy and chaotic, as many people were hoping to have the opportunity. A lot of the people who sponsored the event, which was, by the way, held in support of High Lifeline Canada. It was their Harmony and Hope Gala. They did a great job.
Wonderful.
Some really phenomenal performances, and again, support for such a worthy cause. So we didn't get much of a chance to converse, but that's okay. I wanted to make sure he knew that the city of Vaughan really and truly adores him. We wanted to honor him. And by the way, the normal certificate that we give with the key to the city, we provided him with the standard one. We also had a special one made in Braille.
Excellent.
So that he'd be able to read it himself, which he was really touched by.
And was it difficult to pass this by council in order to get approval to give him the key to the city? I'll bet not. I'll bet it was a no-brainer.
Well, the good news is that the giving out the key to the city is at the discretion of the mayor. So my council colleagues were on stage. They loved the whole idea, but technically we don't actually need council approval. That's the second key to the city that I've given in my tenure. The first one was to Dina Pugliese when she was retiring from breakfast television, and then now to to Maestro Bocelli.
Oh, yes. And a quick question. What does that key unlock? I've always wanted to know.
I don't even know myself. I've been asked that question a few times, but I don't even know.
So. Maybe your front door. Who knows?
Maybe it's the door of my office. I don't even know.
Could be. All right, let's get down to business. Car Rally's bylaw announcement on April the 9th. This was a collaboration between you, the City of Vaughan, and YRP. Very important.
Yeah, hugely important. It's interesting because there's a lot of car enthusiasts and car lovers here in the city of Vaughan. A lot of people, you know, sometimes young people, sometimes older people who'll get together, vintage cars, they do it in the middle of the afternoon. Many of them do it with permits. That's not the issue. That kind of enthusiasm for vintage cars, people who are respectful of the property and the neighboring community, that's not been the problem. The problem we've had the last couple of years, and it really reached became a very bad situation last year. It's these unauthorized illegal events. Hundreds of people show up. They're posted all over social media. No permits, no respect for the property they're on or for the people who live nearby. We're talking about dangerous driving. We're talking about potential other criminal activity. In fact, earlier this year, a young woman was actually shot in the city of Vaughan at one of these illegal car rallies in the Weston and Seven area. Fortunately, she recovered. Vaughan Council, myself and the rest of my council colleagues and YRP, we decided to take a really strong stand and say these are illegal. We're going to be toughening the penalties. We're going to be broadening the criteria or the eligibility for which these penalties and fines will apply. And we're sending a clear message. If you've been participating in these illegal car rallies and putting yourself and others at risk, your free ride is over.
That's a good way to put it. And the reaction so far?
I would say on balance, the reaction has been very good. There are some people who've been a bit concerned that what I described a moment ago, the permitted events for people who are true car enthusiasts who are there just to have a good time and maybe a cup of coffee and check out some of the really awesome cars, the stuff that's very friendly and very sort of acceptable and normal. A few of them have been concerned, will this apply to us? And I've said, look, no, what you're doing is something we understand. Many of them, most of them are permitted. That's totally legal. We understand that. What we're going after is the people who are out there. Some cases they have smoke canisters going off. They have fireworks going off. They're damaging property. And again, they're putting themselves and far too many others at risk. It's a different thing. So people understand it, especially, by the way, if you happen to live close to one of the plazas that's being specifically targeted. Those people are very, very happy with our leadership on this.
Yeah, in other words, you're putting the brakes on this too. So let us move on to something that is a little bit more on the positive side, although the outcome of what you've just discussed is going to be very positive. This is the Host in Vaughan Grant. It's a new fund to enhance tourism in Vaughan. What a great idea.
Yeah, I'm really happy about this. I'm really excited about it. I know our staff here at the city and in economic development and in tourism Vaughan have worked really hard to pull this together. And it's so important because, you know, we're blessed to have a really strong roster of events in our city. We know that already. But we have a lot of people who are looking to do more. People who are here in Vaughan, people who want to, I'll say, invest in Vaughan from outside. And so providing a direct incentive and a grant opportunity to whether it's people who are already on that roster or people who are looking to do some stuff to create even more economic activity by drawing in more tourists, that's definitely something that we want to support. So I'm really excited that we've made this an option for people. And I think it's, our tourism numbers are already very strong in Vaughan. I think you're going to see this help help move that number up even higher. Again, good for the economy, good for job creation, and good to showcase a community that's as incredible as Vaughan.
And Mayor Del Duca, give me an example of what you're talking about. What would be something that would create a tourist attraction, in, if you will? What kind of business or setup?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, so for example, we already have a whole series of a summer lineup, we like to call it, events that take place throughout the summer months. This is just, you know, one example, but we have the concerts in the park, which are a staple here in the city. We do one in every ward, five wards across the city, five concerts. We also have the kickoff event coming up actually not too long from now in the Vaughan Metropolitan Center. A ton of people come out for those events, drawing in more of those people. Something that we definitely could be looking at doing. We have our Winter Festa. We have a lot of external organizations like the Vaughan International Film Festival. We have a music festival that's been started in the last couple of years from interested parties in the community. So these are just some examples. And I'm sure that there's a ton of other people out there, entrepreneurial in nature, who want to do things that they haven't even spoken to us about just yet. Maybe they don't know how to get it off the ground. Maybe they don't have the resources to get it off the ground. What we're talking about with the host and Vaughan Grant will be a really good way of helping them get something magical started.
And how do and when should people apply for something like this?
Yeah, so the grant details and the pre-registration link are available at hostinvaughan.ca. And I would recommend everyone go check that out. The applications for the first intake period are being accepted, but the deadline for those is May the 15th. So if you're listening and you're interested, please, absolutely, hostinvaughan.ca/grant. That's where you'll find all the information you need.
Mayor Del Duca, 77 volunteers were honored earlier this month for their tireless work and utter devotion to helping others. Volunteerism, as you and I both know, it's so important to the fabric of our nation, of our economy, of the psychology of a city like Vaughan.
Absolutely. This is a fan favorite event. In fact, it's one of my favorite events. I'm pretty sure that most of my council colleagues, if not all, would agree with me. It's such a touching evening. This year we had 77 individuals, but we had a great turnout, not just the family and friends of those individuals, but also people from, you know, leaders from across our community who wanted to be there. I think we had easily 300 to 400 people here in our atrium at City Hall to celebrate and showcase those individuals that have stepped forward to volunteer, who definitely do need to be celebrated. It's something that we do every year. We do it during what's known as National Volunteer Week. And this is something that it's really touching. It's really exciting. So to those 77 women and men who were receiving awards this year, I just want to say thank you. But I also want to say thank you to past recipients and all of the other volunteers that we have in Vaughan who really do make our community special.
The City of Vaughan is declaring for the second year in a row May as South Asian Heritage Month. How important is that?
It's very important, certainly for members of the South Asian community who live or work here in Vaughan, but it's also important to me as mayor because it's just another example of how we really have, we don't just talk about being a diverse and inclusive and welcoming community, we really do put those words into action. I have said so many times since becoming mayor, this building, this precinct where City Hall sits, it doesn't belong to me. It doesn't belong to members of council. It belongs to the whole community. This is the people's building, and it's been critical for me to share that message so people know not only that they're welcome here, but that we want them inside the building. We want them to feel comfortable because I believe City Hall is actually representative of the community as a whole. So we have a huge South Asian community in Vaughan. I think it's going to be fantastic. The celebration will be taking place Monday, May 6th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. At Vaughan City Hall, 2141 Major McKenzie Drive. I think it was fun last year. It'll be even more fun this year as we celebrate the incredible richness of South Asian art, heritage, and culture. Everybody is welcome, and this is something we're going to keep celebrating for many, many years.
We're going to look a little bit into the future. There's one of my favorite songs. Now, I'm a little bit older than you, and so this was hot for me way back when. It's called Summer in the City by the Lovin' Spoonful. Summer in the City of Vaughan, what are you most looking forward to?
Well, the Canada Day celebration in the City of Vaughan, the official Canada Day celebration, is always something that's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that, as I always do. I mentioned the concerts in the park. I think those are always upbeat. They draw huge crowds, especially in the aftermath of COVID. People want to be out. They want to be together. So I would say those are the two things that I'm looking most forward to. But I'm also looking forward to the month of July, because that's when I celebrate my next birthday. And that's when many members of my family also celebrate our birthdays. So it's a celebratory month in the Del Duca family household, and I'm looking forward to it.
And it also moves you just a little bit closer to my age. You're such a good sport. Have a wonderful rest of April. Only just a day or two left in this month, and I look forward to speaking with you in May. Thank you, Mayor Stephen Del Duca.
Sounds awesome.
Okay, cheers.
Thank you, Anne. Take care.
When we come back, the true crime documentary based in Markham. This is The Feed on 105.9 The Region. Please stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at 105.9 The Region. Ann Romer and more of The Feed after the break. This is 105.9 The Region.
Welcome back. I'm Ann Romer. From Caitlin Clark to the PWHL, the fan base for women's sports is growing. Jim Lang with the report.
Now, this is no surprise to me, or anyone's been paying attention to women in sports in Canada, but a recent poll found that 2 in 3 Canadians between the age of 13 and 65, approximately 17 million people, consider themselves to be fans of women's sports, and why wouldn't they be? To talk more about it, thrilled to be joined by the person who made this all happen and played a huge role, the CEO of Canadian Women in Sport, Alison Sandmeyer-Graves. Alison, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I see the WNBA, the PWHL, women's amateur athletics, local sports here in New York region. This is not a surprise to me, but even that, how did this scene, those kind of numbers make you feel?
You know, it was really validating and encouraging to see that so many Canadians are fans of women's sports, and this is without having professional teams and leagues consistently playing in our cities across Canada. This is World Cup, and this is Olympics, and this is WNBA. And the fact that this level of fandom has developed even before the first puck drop for the PWHL, because this research was collected in October, tells you that 17 million is where we were at in October, and it's certainly higher now. The moment is now to get more professional sport going in this country for women.
Absolutely. And I think about Larry Tannenbaum and his push to bring a WNBA team to Canada, and looking how many people were at Scotiabank Arena for that exhibition game. It seems to me, Alison, like a no-brainer.
Well, that's certainly the case that we're making at this point. This is our second report. We released one last April as well that really looked at the business case and the roadmap to how we get a thriving professional women's sport market in this country. The fan piece was something we wanted to dig into further because, of course, fans are at the heart of all of it. They're the consumers, those are the ones buying the tickets and the merch and watching online and on broadcast. So we really wanted to see what do Canadians think right now. And the cool thing is they aren't just fans right now, but they are demanding more. And particularly young Canadians are saying, we want more. We're going to engage more if we're given the opportunity. And so for business leaders who are debating this investment in their various boardrooms and meetings, I think the case is very clear at this point that this is a great opportunity and something that Canadians are ready for. And it's going to create tremendous commercial benefit, but also social benefit with that.
Well, and I couldn't agree more, Alison. And I think if I'm a corporate CEO or, you know, CFO or someone in charge of my money for my corporation, I look at 19,000 plus at Scotiabank Arena for a PWHL game. And then that record's broken with 21,000 plus in Montreal.
PWHL is just proving all of this, aren't they? What a tremendous first season. I think that the level of appetite from that very first game, we're going to see it all the way through the playoffs, is so high. And I think this research really tells us this isn't just a moment. This isn't just a first season thing. The demand is there. The interest is there. And so, but of course, unless we invest, we're not going to see that potential fully realized in this country. So we need all the different investors from government to brands to broadcasters and more really rallying around this opportunity and being part of building what could be in this country.
Speaking with Allison Sandmeyer-Graves, the CEO of Canadian Women in Sport, and we're seeing not just evidence in Canada. We recently had the NCAA basketball championships where the women's Final Four had higher ratings than the men's Final Four.
It's a global phenomenon, and that's what's really cool about that. But what's interesting is Canada's actually behind many of our counterparts in terms of developing this professional market in our own country. Canadians are consuming a lot of global content, cross-border content. We need to provide it to them right here in their own cities, in their own markets, so that they can be true fans, and that domestic league, those domestic opportunities are really what's going to make the difference.
I've had the privilege of being able to speak and do some interviews with Erin Ambrose and Natalie Spooner from the PWHL, and they're not just great athletes, but the way they interact with the public and young fans, that has to help the bottom line and the cause of promoting women in sports in this country.
Yeah, the athletes are phenomenal, and we know that access to athletes and following these athletes on social media is a big part of the appeal, particularly for young people. The women athletes, they work hard for their money.
Yeah.
So they are making themselves available. They're making connections. And that is one of the unique advantages that women's sport offers. The women are as much a partner in this process as anybody else. And those athletes are putting the work in.
We look ahead to the Paris Summer Olympics and what's going to happen this summer. And we know there's going to be a number of Canadian women who are going to shine in the international stage. Based on this ammunition, this evidence, this everything you were able to compile, were these young women, these Canadian athletes who medal in Paris, will they be able to parlay that into some advertising and marketing money for them?
Well, that's certainly the goal, and I think this research gives all the more reason for that to come to life. And interestingly, it was actually the last Summer Olympics when our women won gold on the soccer pitch. And they really pushed Canadians and pushed the business community and said, why don't we have a domestic league where these athletes can play professionally in front of Canadians year in and year out? The fact that we're achieving on this stage against all of these countries who have these professional leagues is just exceptional, but we shouldn't expect it. We need that support in Canada too. So it's going to be really exciting to see 4 years later, or I guess 3 years later with COVID and the delay, where we're at as a country and how much further we're prepared to take this conversation coming off of the Olympics.
The future is so bright, Allison. I mean, if we're at this stage now, the next 2 or 3 years, it's actually quite exciting for all sports fans, just for everyone as all Canadians to see how it's evolving. Allison, you and your team at the Canadian Women in Sports Organization have done such remarkable work educating all of us and making sure that their message gets out there. You all should be commended for helping get it to where it is right now.
Well, thank you so much. We're big believers in the power of sport and in the power of women's sport. And I got to say, I don't see us going backwards from here. There's a lot of work to do, but this is really going to change the face of sport in Canada for the better. And just imagine a new normal where boys and girls are watching women play professionally week in, week out, just as they have with men. It's exciting to imagine where that's going to take us as a country.
Couldn't agree more. Allison, thank you so much for your insight. Really appreciate it, and all the best in the future.
Thanks so much.
It was a crime that shocked the residents of Unionville and garnered interest from around the world. A home invasion, murder-for-hire story, now the focus of a Netflix documentary. Glenn Perkins has more.
What Jennifer did went straight to the top spot on Netflix when it was released April 10th. The crime documentary tells the story of Jennifer Pan and the events leading up to the killing of her mother and attempted murder of her father. Jeremy Grimaldi is the executive producer. Jeremy, welcome to the feed.
Thank you for having me.
Your interest in this case goes back to the very beginning. Tell me about that.
At the beginning of the case, there were journalists from basically all over the world. And that slowly filtered out after it began stretching out to 10 months. And meanwhile, I stayed there the whole time. So I had full access and full attention on the case. So I quickly became the expert.
Remind us of those events on the night of November 8th, 2010.
It was one of those stories that the whole city paid attention to very quickly. The way the police began telling it was that it was a random home invasion, i.e. people were driving down the street, they picked a house, They targeted it, they entered it, shot both parents, and robbed the home, meanwhile tying up the young daughter.
This is a crime that not only shocked Markham, Unionville, but many other communities. What was it about this case that resonated so much with people?
I think, first of all, that it appeared random, and she was charged 2 weeks later. And it, in so many ways, it's people's worst nightmare. First, their worst nightmare is that their home, safe and sound, and gunmen come in and shoot members of the family. Second nightmare is father and mother, child, plots a grand scheme to kill the parents.
When you were attending court, what were your thoughts? You were hearing the evidence. What were your thoughts back then?
I recall being fascinated by Jennifer. She was a straight-A student, a prodigious piano player, a figure skater that wanted to go to the Olympics. She was in so many ways the sort of perfect daughter from the outside looking in. But she would ultimately become a murderer. And the fall from grace is a wild one. She was also caught up in a scheme where she tried to lie and she was caught out. So she caught my attention right away. You know, a huge, huge proportion of murderers are men. There's very few female murderers. And children killing their parents is very rare. Coming up with a plot where they're supposed to be the victim, it's never been seen before.
I'd like to talk more about that in a moment, but this developed for you into a book, the Jennifer Pan story that became a bestseller. How did you go about getting the words from your book off the page and bringing them alive on the small screen at Netflix?
I wrote the book. It won a national award where I was given a true crime award for best fiction in 2017. And it was largely quiet for years until I partnered up with a production company in the UK to create the film. I'm the executive producer. I worked with the director, Jenny Popplewell, and we created a documentary that's become a sort of an international phenomenon in many ways.
What I found most interesting were the elements. You have so much police video from the interviews with Jennifer and, of course, with her ex-boyfriend. Tell me about those videos. How did you get them, and how many did you have to sit through?
Oh, I sat through them all, and I watched them all multiple times. I got them from the court while the case was ongoing, from the evidence department. I spent many, many hours with the evidence department sifting through video and exhibits. I ended up publishing them on YouTube, and then they became sort of a, not an urban myth, but they became very well shared on YouTube. It became sort of a phenomenon.
One of the things that I found interesting during that interview process is the demeanor of Jennifer from that very first night when the police were called to her home to the day when she's actually charged.
When I say she's fascinating, it's a lot of it has to do with that. You know, the documentary details the 911 call she makes, where she's crying and hysterical about the murder. She then tries to pull the wool over the investigator's eyes over three separate interviews and interrogations. And in many ways, she's believed through the first two. When she becomes a suspect or a person of interest, the police change tact and they stop treating her like the victim and start treating her like a suspect. And when that happens, her house of cards falls pretty quickly.
Jeremy Grimaldi, executive producer for the Netflix documentary What Jennifer Did, is with us on the feed. Jeremy, there are a number of surprising revelations in your documentary, one of them being an officer involved in the case appears to believe Jennifer's story of the events from that night.
She's an interesting character, isn't she? She sort of, I don't know what the right word is, talked Jennifer off the ledge a number of times when Jennifer's panicking in the room. Her stomach's churning. She needs someone to speak to, and she ends up speaking to this officer. They develop a bit of a relationship. And when the officer finds out, things change pretty quickly. So it was very disappointing for her.
And then there's the interview with the ex-boyfriend, Danny Wong. The way he described their relationship was very revealing. I was left with the feeling that there was conflict between Danny and Jennifer.
It appeared that way. Danny, in his police interview, gave away a few secrets that maybe Jennifer would not have wanted shared, namely that she was caught up in lies and that she was being targeted over the phone by some unnamed people. And that also set police more on her trail.
There was a lone witness, one of the victims, Jennifer Pan's father. He survived the shooting. If he had not survived, if he had not given a statement to police, would Jennifer have been arrested?
I don't really know. I know she may have been able to pull it off, but she made some fatal mistakes. I don't know, but I would suspect she eventually would have tripped up and been found out. But definitely the father surviving was one of the key things that set the police on her trail. The other was finding messages on her phone.
Obviously, this was very shocking for family and friends. But how did the investigating officers hold up? Because this was such an unusual case.
I think they were so experienced that it wasn't that difficult. They were veterans, so I think they handled it pretty well. Although officers like the one you just mentioned were still stunned by it. She was relatively new.
Jennifer Pan received a life sentence with no parole for 25 years. Has that sentence changed?
It's been appealed on a technicality. The appeal was successful in a lower court. The Supreme Court is now looking at whether they should rule on it. The case may be ruled on by the Supreme Court, or it may go to it may go to another trial, or perhaps a few charges will be dropped and she'll remain in prison on other charges. So those are one of the three options.
During the documentary, video was shown of three people entering the home the night of the murder. What's the current situation with those three?
They are all serving time. One of them, Eric Carty, died in prison, unfortunately. He's the only one who's not involved in the appeal or serving time.
Jeremy, thank you for speaking with me today, and congratulations on the Netflix documentary, What Jennifer Did.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate the support.
Next, the Canadian singer-songwriter who began strumming a guitar at the age of 6 and then played in a rock band just a few years later, Shaliza Backus with the homegrown talent.
From rocking out in elementary school to blending all sorts of genres together, Canadian artist Logan Levy's musical journey is a fusion of genres, and he's been crafting original compositions for quite some time now, and he has captivated over 60,000 listeners on Spotify in such a short period of time. That is so cool, and I have to also mention, Logan, you are 15 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about how you got your start in the music industry.
I started playing guitar when I was, I believe, 6 years old, and I started songwriting pretty early, so at about 10 years old. And I released my first single, I believe, last year. But I think it was really from that point, just getting my first song out, that I was able to see, okay, this is a process I like. This is something I want to do. It's really not hard to do. Anyone, if they have a song, they can get it out there and they can have the world hear it, and that's really great.
That's true, and I feel like that is so much easier now. If like for your generation than it is like compared to mine. I mean, you've got TikTok, you've got YouTube at your fingertips. And do you feel like those social media tools have helped you?
I really do. It's fantastic how easy it is for new people to get a start. Obviously, you don't just go viral, but start somewhere. I mean, before it wasn't even possible. You'd have to like have a label right off the bat, but now people can distribute by themselves. So I think that's really great.
Walk us through like the process of you working on a video to post to get your music out there.
Right around the release of my first song, Mess, I did a lot of kind of tutorials on how to play stuff. And then I transitioned with a lot of editing into like singing with them. I also do voice acting, so recently I did a voice acting reel. I'm just trying to make stuff that's fun and approachable, live performances and stuff. A little thing I do is I use sunset lamps in all of my videos because I find they have this really nice hue they give to the videos.
That's so cool. I've seen those, and that is actually really cool. And you are doing all of these things on top of being a kid in high school. You're a Vaughan boy, you're from Maple. So how are you balancing all of that?
It's not easy, especially when you've got like extracurriculars, but it's very possible if you have the dedication. What I always tell people who are like, man, I want to like make music, is that it's about the motivation. If you really want to do it or really want to learn an instrument, you will, and it won't feel like a chore to do.
I love that. That is such great advice. I must say, I think you're really well-spoken for being only 15 years old. And you just released a brand new EP on Friday. We premiered it on the station, well, one of your singles on the station. So tell us about the EP and about the lead single.
This EP is called Romanticized. And the reason for that is a lot of these songs that I write are, they're based off of something, but they're very dramatized, romanticized, as most media is. And this lead song called Equally Obsessed is personally one of the favorite things I've written. And it's very different from what I've been doing. It's piano-centered. There's an orchestra. It was really great to do. I worked with producer Greg Cavana, and he did the orchestral track, and that was a really great experience. But it's basically a song about finding yourself mentally. It's about when you're obsessed with your partner, essentially, but you start to wonder if you're the issue for being so obsessed with them that they can't reciprocate that same kind of love back to you.
You know, that is really deep for a 15-year-old. It kind of reminds me of the album that is on top of the world right now, Taylor Swift's The Tortured Poets Department. Now, Taylor has a very specific writing style, and I feel like her writing style inspires a lot of artists. So I want to know who inspires you.
In terms of, actually recently, this isn't any of the stuff I've put out yet, but Dominic Fike, I love his vocal style, I love his instrumentals, I love his guitar. He's a really big influence for me. I'd say in terms of singing style, though, Rule, who is an Australian singer, fantastic. I love his vocal style, I love his instrumentals. So that's the stuff I pay attention to. And obviously, Shawn Mendes, who a lot of people say I sound a little bit like. But I'd say a lot of mainstream pop singers with, they just have a lot of strong vocals, and that's something I pay a lot of attention to.
Okay, you've been picking up all of these instruments. What do you know how to play so far, and what are you learning?
So currently I'm learning bass, which is really fun to me because bass is something I would say that's my highest priority in songs, is a punchy and fun bass line. That's what I spend the most time on. And I'm learning cello, which is kind of similar, a bit harder because it's a string instrument. I used to play violin. I played violin for 3 years, but I stopped recently. And then my main instruments are guitar and piano, which piano I've only been playing for 2 years, but guitar I've been playing for, I believe, 9 years. And singing, if we count that.
Yes, so. Your voice is an instrument. It really is. And Logan, this is so exciting. As I mentioned, you're only 15 years old. You just released your first EP. So what's next for you? What are the next steps you want to take?
I have so much planned. If I lined up every song I have that I could like bring to a producer and make, I would have like till 2026, which is kind of great, but then it's really difficult because I'm like, oh man, I really want to do this one next. I have to like stop myself. I'm like, okay, take it one at a time. You have enough. You're not going to run out. So I guess that's good. I have a lot prepared and a lot I want to get out there. So it's just a process of, obviously I've got school to balance. I've got extracurriculars to balance, but even now I'm working on my next song past this EP. And I've got the next ones. I'm really excited to do them. So I'm going to have some more singles coming out. Then I'm going to have probably another EP or an album coming out. But yeah, I'm not going to stop anytime soon.
And you absolutely shouldn't. That is so exciting, Logan. And if our listeners want to find you and connect with you, how can we do that?
So you can find me on Spotify, Instagram, TikTok, and a few other platforms, Apple Music as well. My name is just Logan Levy. You can search up my songs. I'm Fine Mess. And now Equally Obsessed as well. That rhymes. And yeah, social media, Logan_Levy_official on Instagram and TikTok.
Logan Levy, thank you so much. And we wish you all the best. You are going to be a star.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you missed any part of the feed, please go to 1059theregion.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Audible. I'm Ann Rohmer. Thank you so much for listening.